Hello, and welcome to episode 71 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Atlanta, Georgia, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Jennifer Jun, Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Fellow at the Center for the History of Political Economy at Duke University. Jennifer's research centers in the history and philosophy of science, especially in a number of issues in the methodology of economics. These include the role played by so-called ceteris paribus laws and the use of idealization in economics. Adopting an HPS approach, Jennifer exposes in detail analogies between economic theorizing and thermodynamics, including the use of equilibrium concepts in both and issues about the relationship between levels of modeling in both disciplines. Her work has many interesting implications for issues in the philosophy of science, philosophy, and in science more generally, including issues about the status of causal generalizations that the special sciences are able to formulate, and the role of idealizations in science that seek to capture features of actually existing science as carried out with partial knowledge by finite, limited human beings. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Jennifer. Dr. Jennifer Jun, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this Thursday morning, afternoon?
I'm doing pretty well. It's a beautiful day here in Durham, North Carolina.
Yeah, you're calling us from Durham. You're currently in your relatively new post at Duke University, is that right?
That's right.
Great.
I'm finishing up my second year here, and unfortunately the whole year has been on, you know, some version of COVID lockdown.
I was kind of looking through a little bit of your where you've been teaching and doing research, and that's got to be something with like essentially the entire second year being online. How's that been so far?
So I mean, since it's been a year, I've adapted, but things seem to be moving along. I am optimistic things in the fall will be closer to normal, but the COVID stuff started in the middle of my second semester of my first year here.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like coming somewhere as a really excited freshman and then being told you have to go home, right? Just, you know, I guess the faculty version of it. This year, I did have the chance to teach one class that was in person.
Oh, okay.
And it was a little bit weird because, you know, all the kids come in masked up. They sit really far apart. Our class had 20 kids in it or so, but we're in a huge biology lecture hall to keep them, you know, far away from each other and so on. But I did get a chance to do a little bit of in-person teaching.
Okay, but different. What was the course?
This was a course I taught with Alex Rosenberg. We have a philosophy and methodology of economics course here at the undergraduate level.
Very interesting. So what mm-hmm. philosophy of the methodology of economics? So are these folks who are these students from the business school? Or are these mostly or philosophy students or kind of a range?
There's that was the last semester. So I'm thinking, I think we had quite a few econ majors. This is, I think, cross-listed as an economics course. So we had a few of those. We actually also had a handful of students that were in policy-related majors. So that was great.
Nice.
But apart from that, I don't remember any other patterns. about where the students were coming from. But we did have quite a few economics majors. That's true.
Cool. All right. Well, are you guys? I guess we'll see what happens in the fall if you're going back all to full in-person teaching, or will it be like mostly online?
I don't think it will be mostly online. So I'm co-teaching an epistemology class this fall with another colleague, Ben Ava, who has also recently arrived here. And we requested for it to be in person. Vaccines are pretty well underway in terms of who my department has gotten them. I think they're offering it to students now. I think they're required to get it if they want to return to campus. So I don't think it will be mostly online, though I'm not sure it will be totally back to what it used to be.
Sure. And in terms of, let's say, online conferences and things, have you been enjoying the adaptation to that? Are you ready to get back to going to conferences?
I have mixed feelings, and in the sense that I like both. So I miss in-person conferences. For instance, there are philosophy of science conferences. Like the PSA is a conference where I go and I see all my favorite people in the profession and go to all these interesting talks.
It's been like since 2018.
Right. And so I miss conferences where I can see people again.
Right.
But on the other hand, I actually do also really enjoy online conferences. Sometimes I sneak into things that are outside of Duke. And I'll go to economics talks and, you know, come in my pajamas and just be incognito, and it's great. And so there are lots of things that I've been able to go to that would have been a pain in the butt to do.
That's a really interesting point, because it's things that, like, you couldn't necessarily justify, maybe, per se, like, especially in choosing, and just the flexibility of being able to hop into a lecture or even to just attend one session of something that's related or perhaps completely unrelated to your talk, your topic. But
I've gone to a number of things that are just totally unrelated to things that I'm doing at the moment.
Sure.
And I dig it. So I think my feelings go both ways. I think we have to start thinking really carefully about what kinds of activities will merit travel. I know climate is a thing that's on people's minds, but on the other hand, I think there are some activities that warrant being in person. So we'll see how that.
Yeah, it's just really hard to say the conference outside of the conference and, you know, small workshops and things like that. I know, but yeah, other professions outside of academia have really, you know, consulting, I don't know, any kind of other further travel business related. It's kind of been seen that we don't need to travel as much, but perhaps there's an argument that, yeah, I think generally people kind of just want to be, you know, connected and together. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how things shape up in the next year or going forward, what we're going to see. So, all right. Well, so I'm interested to get to hear, cause you, as you've mentioned, you've been teaching some economics courses related to your work in history and philosophy of science as it relates to economics and other things, but I'm interested to see what kind of trajectory that took. Looking back at a little bit of your history, you studied both economics and in philosophy, but even before that, I'm just curious. Let's hear a little bit about the origin story. So Jennifer, tell us. I want to get to know you. So tell us a little about where you grew up.
So I grew up until I was about 10 or 11. I spent most of my childhood in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And around that age, we moved to Massachusetts.
Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What were parents up to?
So my parents were graduate students while I was growing up. So when I was a little
really?
Kid, I lived in graduate student housing.
No way.
Like a kid.
What were they studying?
So my father was in computer science and my mother was in developmental psychology.
Okay. Did they meet in school or was this?
I think so. I think they were college sweethearts.
Okay. Yeah. And then, but different fields at least going into it. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So being quite around that. Okay. And so I imagine, so growing up in Oklahoma, was this something where they were studying it at a university in Oklahoma and
Okay. Yeah, they were at Oklahoma State University, so we were in Stillwater for most of the time. We were in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And so I imagine, was the move to, where do you say, you said Massachusetts?
Yeah, so we moved to Massachusetts. We were in Gloucester for a year when we first got there, which is, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie A Perfect Storm. This is
a long time ago. I remember.
A seaside town for a year. And then we moved to where my family is currently based now, which is Boxford, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yeah. But shortly after we got there was when I started high school. So I went to a private high school called Phillips Academy Andover, and I was a boarding student. So I wasn't at home a whole lot once we moved to Massachusetts and once I started high school.
What was Phillips Academy like?
It is it's a remarkable place. It's where it's a place where you can go and you find out that everybody is amazing and talented and a genius, and you're not the only one. So it's intimidating in that sense. It's basically, it feels like what I imagine like the college liberal arts experience would be. So that's the best way I could put it. Like whatever you think would go on at college liberal arts, that's kind of what happens in Andover.
Bring it in 4 years earlier into the high school experience. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So was it, I suppose at this, you know, high school, is it something, I guess, what were you interested in?
I was interested in things that were completely different.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
For whatever reason, I decided in high school that I was not good at science.
as the story of many philosophers of science, but
That was where I decided I wasn't good at science. I really loved foreign languages and fiction writing, and so during that time, that was what I thought I was going to end up doing. I thought I was going to be some combination of like an economics and Spanish major once I got to college, and as you know, that is not what happened.
No, but so you were interested. You did some writing growing up, mm-hmm. or were interested in like short stories, poems, things like that.
Mostly short fiction was what I enjoyed doing the most, and so that was something that was on my mind at the time.
From moving on from Phillips Academy, mm-hmm. I suppose what so wanting to go into fiction writing. Where did you? So you decided to go. Was it at Northwestern?
Yep, but that's where I went.
All right. I've been Evanston. I've visited. I've seen the sights. I've taken the train up. I forget which line it was from Chicago, having lived there for a bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I never had the full Chicago experience, but I've lived there a couple summers.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was.
What were you doing?
So, unrelated to philosophy or science, I don't know if you've ever heard of like the comedy scene out in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing. So during undergrad while I was not studying outside of my psychology and neuroscience classes, I'd be doing like sketch comedy and improv. And so yeah, we moved out there for a summer to me and some friends to like take some of those courses and in improvisation and in writing and things like that. So very cool. Yeah, there was one of our friends was studying at the there at Columbia College, which was like kind of an art school. But in our courses we had some other Northwestern students. I think they have like a really good playwriting program there as well, Chicago in the summer, beautiful Illinois, and I imagine other times of the year as well, but.
I did go to Northwestern. That is true. and I took a totally different direction. Everything kind of after this point happens kind of by accident. So I get there.
Right.
And I figure, here's the thing I feel like I should know something about: economics.
And why was that?
I have no idea. I don't even know why. So economics was actually something that was offered at Andover too, but I never took any of it. But a lot of my friends did.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
And so once I got to Northwestern, one of the things that it's really good in is economics. So I thought, well, I'm here, so here's the thing I don't know anything about, and maybe I should. So I will take some economics classes. And the first class that I took was a macro course, and I did really terribly in it. And at this point, I suppose I could have stopped taking economics courses, but I was really stubborn about it. I thought, well, I would like to take some more to see if I can't get better. And then I ended up doing a major.
So what, perhaps in terms of like certain questions related to economics, can you recall anything of, you know, curiosity in terms of, what made you, I suppose, persist in that, continuing to take economics courses? I mean, it could have been practical as well. Obviously it's a great major. It's a, it's a solid in terms of professional choice, but curious if there's, were there any other, sort of intellectual questions there at the time?
Yeah, there are a couple of different things. One was, and this is something that became really apparent in micro courses, which is I thought it was really remarkable that you had this whole discipline where you could talk about like people's desires in terms of utility functions. And that notion, I was like, this is amazing.
So could you say a little bit more just to describe exactly, you know, kind of what does that look like?
Yeah. So when you're thinking about, say, agents that are trying to make a decision, right, you can formalize this in what gets called the utility function. You can figure out what kinds of choices will give certain amounts of happiness or what have you, right? So everything turns into like an optimization problem of some kind, right? And I just thought this was really cool. I don't know why it was really cool, but I think just the fact that you could do it, there's this thing in the background, which is, you know, what is it that you want as a person? What are your preferences for this or that or the other? And you can turn that into math. So
right.
I know there's a lot of us who are commenting on the mathematical nature of economics these days in philosophy of science, but the fact that you could do this and that people did do this,
right,
and that this was canonical economics at this time, right? Yeah. I just thought that was remarkable. And then the second related mm-hmm. thing that I think drew me to it was that a lot of things, these are, you're engaging in problem solving. Right. And this was something that I also found attractive about, like, taking just straight up math courses. Like, you have to figure out what the problem is, set the problem up in a certain way, and then solve it. And that way of just framing the process was something that I found really appealing.
Yeah. And I suppose, yes. Absolutely. And so I noticed you were studying philosophy, or excuse me, economics, but then simultaneously also started getting into philosophy. Is that right?
So actually it was not simultaneous. So this was another step that was a total accident.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
So I had gone into college with enough AP credits to get out of a lot of things.
Sure.
I took mostly economics classes for 2 years and then I was finished with the requirements.
Wow.
So I had this time. At the time I was thinking about going to law school. Mm-hmm. And so I called my father and I said, I have 2 years. I think I want to go to law school. I don't know what else to major in. What do I do? And he says, let me go ask my coworker. I'll call you tomorrow. Calls me the next day. He goes, my coworker tells me that that philosophy is really good for preparation to law school, and that history is really good for preparation for law school.
So you're like, all right, let's get in.
I had a bad history experience in high school, so I thought, okay, I'm no good at that. I wasn't that good in my philosophy class in high school either, so I don't know what happened here. But basically,
it's amazing how those early on experiences can completely either lead us down something or not.
Yeah. So between the two of those, I thought, like, I convinced myself that, okay, I wouldn't have been good at history, so philosophy it was.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's how I started taking philosophy classes.
Okay. So a practical decision to going toward law school. Mm-hmm. But that, so you were thinking about law and then, mm-hmm. okay. So what, I don't know. So I see here, like, did you end up applying, getting, you know, attending law school for a little bit, or did you
I think I ended up liking philosophy right away. Mm-hmm. And so I just stuck with that. I did a year abroad, went to Oxford during my junior year. And during that time had become really set on applying to graduate schools in philosophy. So the law school thing was out the window, much to my father's disappointment.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So mm-hmm. understanding, how did you end up then justifying a degree in philosophy?
Oh gosh.
Probably a sensitive subject. Sorry about.
I think the idea was I would try to apply to grad school, and like if I could get into a decent graduate program, right? I would give it a go. If it didn't work out, I could still go to law school. So
Of course.
I was just like, here's something. It's still on the table. Don't worry. So I think it was partly that.
Okay. Well, certainly getting, I mean, you know, so getting into, so you went, going into graduate school and then selecting University of Pittsburgh. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
Great. Which obviously has an incredible philosophy program, a lot of well-known scholars and researchers. And also, you know, happens to be one of the, essentially one of the centers of philosophy of science.
That's right. So here's a fun fact. So I was in the philosophy department, not the HPS department.
Right.
I had
right.
never taken a philosophy of science class before college. I didn't really even know this was a thing. I started philosophy graduate school thinking I was going to work on philosophy of perception.
Interesting.
Yeah. So not even in philosophy of psych, not even philosophy of psych, like psychology, neuroscience, like not even there.
Right. Right. There's
philosophy of perception.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just completely almost, it just focused on a different level of analysis, I suppose, in terms of just like perception.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So more like conceptual analysis about
conceptual
what it is that,
philosophy of mm-hmm. mind or something like that. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. So, all right. So what's the story behind eventually? Yeah. A lot of us who find in philosophy of science are rarely introduced earlier on in, you know, high school, even perhaps even undergraduate. So, you know, what was it that, what was it, a course? Was it a reading? Like what, started to lead you toward away from maybe more traditional philosophical study and research toward, this engaging, interesting field of philosophy of science?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can see this, like this whole history is a trajectory of accidents,
right? That's always the best way.
So basically the same thing happened here. So at Pittsburgh, in addition to the metaphysics and epistemology core and the ethics core, one of the things that was offered was a philosophy of science core.
Okay.
And so on I don't remember if it was, I don't think it was required. Maybe it was, I don't think it was, but I took it. Here was a thing that, it sounds like philosophy of science sounds cool. So,
right.
And it was something I didn't know anything about. So I took it, and Mark Wilson was teaching it the year I did. Yep. And from then on, I was hooked.
Okay.
And then practical things get in the way. So I had some interest in philosophy of science / thinking about continuing projects that were related to economics. And then on the one hand, this philosophy of perception stuff. And at some point, Mark, who eventually became my advisor, he was giving me advice on how to get ready for the job market, how to think about the future as I was continuing the program. And what I realized was I had to just make some decisions about what kind of philosopher I had to be. Was I going to be someone who did science? Was I going to be someone who did mind? Something else? I think what I realized was I had nothing more to say about philosophy of perception in the way that I had been working on it.
Could you share perhaps, you know, maybe some things that you had been working on, or what kinds of things?
Sure. Sure. So I had been thinking about, I've been reading a lot of John McDowell and Neil Gupta, authors in that area, thinking about what the content of perceptual experiences was, like what made perceptual experience rational experience, mm-hmm. and things of that matter. So I had written, you know, a seminar paper on whether or not the content of perceptual experiences were propositional or not, whether there was intentional content or not. And I reached a point where I thought, at the conceptual level, I had very little more to say. There had been this question about perception that I'd wanted to answer. I felt that I had answered it to my satisfaction, and to go further would actually require probably going into the sciences, which I had no background in.
Right. So then becoming more a philosopher of psychology or like going further deeper into or neuroscience or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, granted, it doesn't necessarily have to be the case where a conceptual analysis runs into a wall and then it's like, okay, I guess we have to let the science take over. But I felt that in this case, if I were to continue in that direction, that would have been the move to make. And I still had this interest in economics on the side.
Yeah.
So, and there were some overlapping themes that I'd also found interesting in economics, which was, how do you think about rational behavior? How do we make sense of why do economists do the things that they do, right? So I just went off in that direction instead.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your project, your dissertation project, which I think has fairly recently been turned into some papers. Tell us a little bit about how you've kind of approached and thought about doing philosophy of science, or I guess I'm not sure how you would refer to it, philosophy of economics, or some of the big questions that you were hoping to answer or address, and how you did it.
Yeah, so this was at the time where I was starting to think about, okay, there are certain kinds of reasoning strategies that you find in economics that are ubiquitous, right? Like equilibrium reasoning, right? That's a benchmark standard for whatever it is that you're up to. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, why do we use this bit of reasoning at all? And in particular, why do we use it when, for instance, we know that nothing is ever at equilibrium? Right? Like, what good is it doing for us here? And there are two things, which is one, it's got an epistemic role. That's interesting, right? And two, this epistemic role is actually pretty similar to what's going on in other sciences that don't face the criticism quite as economics does, that they're not a real science and are, you know, serious in a way that economics isn't. So, yeah, so one, like, equilibrium reasoning has a role to play, right? And then two, it's very similar to what actually goes on in places like physics or the material sciences.
Interesting. So I'm really fascinated. Yeah. So in reading your paper on what's the point of ceteris paribus?
That's right. Yeah.
Ceteris paribus. Forgive my Latin pronunciation. So how did you make that connection? How did you come to make the connection between these examples in physics and really draw this analogy between the kinds of reasoning that were essentially going on, or as you're arguing, are going on in physics as well as economics?
Mm-hmm. So this is where I have to credit my advisors with a lot of help.
Okay. Yeah.
Because again, I had no physics background. I mean, hadn't taken science since I was 17. And so I had no idea what was going on in the area. But Mark also thinks about reasoning strategies and how to manage in a world that's really complex. And he was the one that actually pointed out to me, there's this example that kind of reminds me of what's going on in the economics case, where you have these processes that they're kind of, you know, taken out of time, right? They tell you something about the efficiency or the optimality of doing one thing or another, right? Doesn't it seem like something like the Carnot engine? Isn't that doing pretty much the same thing? So he was the one really that brought my attention to this particular case that really no one craps on the Carnot engine as oh no, like that doesn't tell us anything about the real world. Like, sure it does, right? It won't describe any real Carnot engine, but it will tell you something about entropy, for example.
So for those of us who might not be familiar, so the Carnot engine, what was the sort of the purpose of, you know, this particular, you know, a model or demonstration?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of the Carnot engine, I'm simplifying a lot, is how does this device take in, I think, like energy and turn it into work?
Okay.
How do we draw out that process? And what it does is that it, in quote, idealizes a lot of things. Like, as this engine is doing work, right, we have to posit things like that all these processes that it's going through are irreversible, or it's are reversible, I'm sorry. So anything that you do forward, you can do backward. Right? Each step takes an infinite amount of time, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's a very highly idealized process that tells you the maximum efficiency of a particular engine that's moving between heat reservoirs of certain temperatures. Right? But by knowing the temperatures of the cold water bath and the hot water bath, right, mm-hmm. I can tell you how much work that engine can do. Right? And no engine, given the temperature differential, no engine will do better. Right? So it might not tell me about any particular real engine, but it will tell me the threshold. Right? of what real engines could be.
Okay. And so you described a little bit about, you know, drawing this analogy to the ways in which reasoning in physics, had those reasonings in physics been sort of explored or explicated in the way that you've done so before? Meaning, you know, have people thought about them in that kind of way? And then it was just more just kind of pairing the two together to realize, hey, this is, you know, yeah, I'm just a little curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The big example that sticks out in my mind is, I think Nancy Cartwright is telling a very similar story. So we put a different emphasis, like I put this emphasis on efficiency and like maximal efficiency and stuff like that. But I think the story that we're telling is actually really similar and rooted in the same kind of insight, which is, look, when you have a model, what do you do with it? Well, you're trying to see where it fits in this world. Right? Yeah. So what you're trying to look, you're trying to find out what the relevant causal processes are that you're interested in. Right? And you're trying to find out where best the schematic will fit in order to tell you something. So yeah, I mean, like, I think this thought has been around for a while.
Right. So I guess, you know, in applying this thought to then things like supply and demand curves and thoughts in economics, you know, how does this change the way we might think about economics, or how does this change the way we think about the reasoning related to this particular model in particular?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think here's a criticism that you see a lot from, you know, the news or you know, from talking to friends, which is, economics isn't—it's a total failure. It didn't tell us when the crisis was happening.
I hear that all the time,
et cetera.
From other philosophers of science or something like that. Right. They're like,
The idea is, it like does a bad job because one, it failed at being predictive, and then two, because its models are too idealized or something like that.
Right. That sounds right.
Right. And so the idea is, look, there's a way of thinking about idealized models. My colleague Kevin Hoover is going to kill me for using this word idealization so much in his interview.
An overused kind of
Well, I'll tell you why in a second.
Sure.
So remind me if I forget to tell you why. But the idea is, no, I mean, like, look, there are supply and demand models that are used, and in a lot of circumstances they work perfectly fine, right? And that's because the circumstances under which they're applied fit. So if you have like a really simple supply demand model, I care about, I don't know, the market for, this is so boring, the market for widgets or something like that, local Durham widgets.
Right? Sure.
It's feasible to think like I could identify the relevant causal factors for this good, which is, you know, local to this particular area, so on and so forth. Of course, that's not going to work if what I care about is the economy for, you know, consumable goods or something like that, right? There are just so many more causal factors that are in play, and that's fine. But if you can find where a model will fit, it will tell you something, right? And then on top of that, right, a lot of these models are really good for counterfactual reasoning. Like if you can find a pocket of the economy where the model fits and you're thinking, what would happen if one other thing in the model changes? These are models that will help you do that in a fairly straightforward or transparent way. Hmm. So that's the way in which I think that they can be useful. One of the things that predictive failure can indicate, for instance, in the case of the crash, and something I've been thinking about is, okay, one objection to standard models that were being used at the time, given the crash, was that they were missing certain causal features that were really important. And so then the idea that I think the interesting question going forward is, well, then what do we do about these models that, you know, central banks use them too, right? What do we do about these models that seem to miss important causal factors the first time around? Do we just add them back in? Do we do something else? And I think that question actually will be answered in really probably not straightforward ways. I have a project that's on this that I can tell you about later. But I don't know if that answered your question, did it?
A little, yeah, no, I mean, well, it certainly provided like great, I think a richer picture of what exactly, how to think about these particular models in ways that, and I guess explaining that it's a little bit more complicated and perhaps providing a better explanation, especially in under, I suppose a more, maybe an optimistic picture of what exactly these models can do and what it is they're doing. And that has been quite helpful. Yeah. I'm curious how,
So here's one thing that I'll add. So this is another version of what I've been trying to say, maybe a little bit more elegantly, is a model will tell you something about what the world looks like in order for it to behave the way the model will say it does. Right? So what are the conditions that have to hold in order for this model to be applicable? I think that's something that interesting that comes out. And then when it does hold, that's great.
Yeah. I'm curious. So in terms of, do you make any reference, I suppose, to like other, so models in science is a huge topic. I remember taking a models course with Lisa Lloyd, and we read, you know, we read Cartwright, we read all the famous folks. We did a little bit of, I can't remember if we did a lot of work with economic models, but I think we maybe did like 1 or 2 weeks. A lot of it was climate models, because that's been kind of like big now or in this kind of way. But I suppose if we were just to think about, you know, the study of modeling, how has your work been kind of perhaps, you know, related to the kinds of work that others are doing in related sciences? So like, how are you approaching models in economics, and does it ever have any more either general, I guess, yeah, two questions. One, how does it relate to approaching models from other specialties and sciences? And then two, does your work with models of economics kind of, you know, what are some general, does it have any more general implications that could be said or thought about when folks are doing work or considering models in these other sciences?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer is yes, there are some related themes that you'll find with people who are working in philosophy of economics as opposed to philosophy of climate science and climate modeling. And the big thing that unites us is, how do you possibly even model a system that's so complex in an adequate way? And one thing that ties us in common is that one answer is, you don't use one, you use many models, right? And the question then is, like, how do you adjudicate between all these different models? A lot of times, well, there are cases in philosophy science where what you do is you have two models and you kind of just put them together, right? But in the other case, that's actually not something that happens. So let me give you an example. This is a project I'm working on right now. And it's about modeling practices at the Bank of England. So the Bank of England has a main model, but it lives kind of in an ecosystem with a bunch of other resources, including other satellite models that an economist can pull off the shelf if need be. Right? Now, this model that's at the center still doesn't have a financial sector, at least not explicitly. Right? Like, this is what they use now. And so you're thinking, like, what do you do to supplement this thing that maybe should be there? You pull another model off the shelf. Right? This model is going to be a little bit different in the sense that perhaps it will be missing some detail, but it may include the financial sector explicitly, what have you. There are lots of different things that models in this ecosystem can do. Some of them will be, ones that you can interpret causally, so you can use them to use counterfactual reasoning. Some of these will be more data forward, so maybe better for forecasting. But what the economist does is they pull this model off the shelf and try to figure out how to incorporate insights, information from the one model into the main model that's driving the whole narrative. And here's something that doesn't happen. You don't just stick the two models together. So the case that I'm thinking about, you have a main model, no financial sector. You have a satellite model that does. Right? And so I think, okay, I'm going to try to figure out what the dynamics of a disturbance to the economy will look like in the satellite model, and then import that into my main model, which by the end of the exercise still doesn't have the financial sector, but it will behave as if it does. For your purposes, So that's one really kind of non-straightforward way that economists will try to make up for deficiencies in models, is that you'll reach for other models and then try to integrate that information together. Right? And I suspect that in any kind of science that deals with complex systems, something like that is going to have to happen. And this is a process that's not algorithmic. Right? It's a process that involves a lot of creativity. Mm-hmm. This is also the case at in the States, in the federal, at the Federal Reserve, is that practicing economists are fairly open about the fact that these forecasts that they use with these models, that they're called judgmental forecasts. Okay. So a lot of just expert judgment is going to have a huge role in shaping the final product. Okay. So there's a lot of like interesting fuzziness there that goes on. And I think that's going to be something that we find quite generally.
Very interesting. So, yeah, I appreciate you sharing some of your, I would say, yeah, definitely current work. And so some of your work has been, definitely in terms of your dissertation and in understanding like current models and the way they've related to the other sciences. I'm kind of curious about then, you mentioned like a case of like a particular bank. How much is your current work, looking toward, current examples of current models and then making sense of like, I guess, almost like a kind of a in practice approach to understanding this stuff. So is that, because, you kind of approach this from a way, maybe I'm not sure if maybe Cartwright has done this more so, but like really trying to just provide some sort of general explanation or general philosophy of science, points related to modeling and economics. But it sounds to me like you might be taking is it a little bit more of an in practice approach to like currently what people are doing or what people are up to in economics today and how how to make sense of that. I'm curious to hear kind of your thoughts on your approach.
So I think the things that I'm working on right now are definitely this movement that's gaining a lot of momentum, which is like how should we think about science and practice? Mm. Right? And so whenever I'm working on economics, I want to be actually paying attention to what is it actually that economists are doing, right? And that's something that's really important to me. Now, that's not to say that I don't think you could switch like historical windows, right? So in the Ceteris Paribus paper, what I was trying to get at was, here's this question that philosophers of science, like not just in economics, but in physics too, for example, here's the thing that people are getting confused about Ceteris Paribus. Here's this answer that was already given, at the turn of the century.
Right.
So I think it's also useful to think about we've been talking about Ceteris Paribus forever, and it's like this dude, right, said pretty much the same thing that I'm trying to draw attention to like 100 years ago.
right. That's yeah. Right?
And I think it's useful to look at to do philosophy of science in a way that's historically informed. Right. I think that's a good thing to do, because otherwise we start talking about things like, this was my beef in the Ceteris Paribus paper, which was there's this thought that, oh, you have this Ceteris Paribus clause. What you need to do is you need to fill out the Ceteris Paribus blank. Just put in all the details you didn't put in the first time, and then you'll get something like a true statement. That's the way it works. I'm just like, no. And that's not the way it worked for forever.
That's important. And I think that would be, that's like a whole career of like, basically plugging the holes of the ways in which we will like to think about certain models or the way of modeling practices. And it just, it takes, the weaving together though of that, it takes, like I said, like it takes working with, someone who's been familiar with that or that particular kind of reasoning or making that connection and saying, I think that looks, I know that from somewhere kind of a thing. So but then it takes like the work like yourself is doing. So in really, really making the argument that that is the case. And this is, and then this is why it's important to see.
Yeah. I mean, history is really hard. And it requires that you go digging around in these texts that don't read anything like the texts they do today. Or, you know, I know a bunch of people who spend a lot of their time in archives and they're always trying to hunt things down. And or if not hunt something specific down, they just have to gather a lot of data and then try to figure out what is it that's out of this data that, that will help them out answering a particular question. So I mean, it's hard to do good history.
Yeah. So you introduce yourself, yeah, as a historian and philosopher of science, historian and philosopher of economics. And so, yeah, is that what you're, you know, are you working on any HPS papers at the moment, or have any thoughts of maybe future work to do in history and philosophy of science?
So I think I identify as a philosopher of science first.
Okay.
And then mostly try to do philosophy of science in this way that I've said, like it's historically informed. I also pull double duty as a faculty fellow here at the Center for the History of Political Economy.
Okay.
I'm trying to be increasingly sensitive to history and being this historically informed philosopher of science. There are a couple of things that I have on the back burner that are more historical in nature. One is this project on Hermann Wold, who kind of dropped out of history, and even though I think he had important things to say about causation and econometrics. And the other thing that I actually have in the background is this is totally, it's going to seem random, is actually about Hobbes. And I have a very, very early stage project on Hobbes. It may not go anywhere, but I have general interest in analogical reasoning.
Okay.
Right. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is just like just analogical reasoning in these different contexts. And one thing that I thought was an interesting question was we read Hobbes's Leviathan, you know, in every intro to political philosophy class, right? And it's fairly clear that this is a kind of in quote idealization, right? But there are certain, I think, real world consequences that Hobbes was trying to get at, and one of the things that's in the vicinity of this is he had thoughts about colonization, for example, right? And the transformation of this one kind of society, if they could call it a society, right, in his eyes, into a different kind of society, right? So there are these like real world analogs of the Leviathan story, and what I'm interested in is thinking about from a historical and philosophical standpoint, what made that analogy connect, right, between these this idealized thought experiment and these real world interests that Hobbes had about America, for instance. So I mean, I know that's like totally
no that sounds that sounds fascinating. I'd love to I mean, that sounds like a fascinating historical and sort of a historical or a philosophy project, historically informed. Okay. So you just mentioned something about being a member of, you said it's something like a Center for Political Economy?
Yeah, it's a Center for the History of Political Economy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Or in short, it's the Hope Center.
The Hope Center. So, you know, so yeah, so now as I suppose we can kind of catch up in terms of a career wise, doing all this work, you taught at Lake Forest for a little bit.
That's right. I was there for 3 years.
And is that I imagine working in philosophy of science, and then most recently though having taken the post at Duke. So what does this look like in terms of, you know, so being a member of a variety of different centers or disciplines? Like what is your role in the history of political economy, the Hope Center?
So at the moment, I sit on like the steering committee. I'm on the editorial board for the flagship journal. But what I keep my eye out on the most is, so we have these workshops for fellows, for visiting fellows who come. They have projects they want to work on. We have presentations every Friday. What I'm always on the lookout for is the following, which is one in particular, if they're interested in philosophy or methodology of economics, this is an area that I'm most familiar with, so I can try to be helpful in that dimension, right? But I'm also like, this is like the historical aspiration in me, given that I thought I was so bad at history, but now it's something that's really important when I think about philosophy,
right?
Is here's the thing about history, which is historians are always trying to tell some kind of interesting story, right? And as someone who wasn't trained in history and is kind of coming at it from a different angle, I think what I'm able to do is identify when I feel like the story is going off the rails, or when I can't figure out what the story is, for example, right? So there are small ways that I try to be helpful there.
So do you have an example of perhaps a moment then you've been exploring or perhaps looking at others' work where the story goes off the rails?
Oh, let's see. I don't want to put anybody. I don't want to name anyone in particular.
Okay. Gotcha.
There is something that happens. I think this is like a historian's challenge, is that historians, when they're writing, know what they're dealing with is something really, really hard and really complex. And there's no right. easy way to construct a tidy narrative. I think one thing that can happen is that a historian will encounter this thing that's complex and then say to the audience, to the reader, here's a lot.
Hmm.
And then it's hard for the author, then it's hard for the reader to figure out what's the trajectory of this narrative. What narrative are you telling? Right. I think that's the thing that can happen, is that just given that there's so much to kind of, put that in the face of your reader, and that makes it really difficult to see what the lesson is.
Yeah.
So it's always a really difficult balance for the historian to like try to tell this narrative and then be faithful to the fact that that it's a complex one.
Of course. Well, yeah, and I suppose that's the job of a good historian then, is to be able to, mm-hmm. perhaps use the narrative as a tool to then explain something that's obviously not going to be like this, but be able to draw out the lessons though too. I mean, that's mm-hmm. That's where the perhaps maybe some of the more philosophical but the good historian should, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I've read some things really recently where I had that reaction where I was like, I don't really know what story you're telling. This is a lot. So that's why I'm having this reaction now.
Interesting. I wonder if that's a reaction to people like consciously not wanting to then tell the simplified story and just wanting to say, I don't know if that's a style of history. I'm not trained enough in history, to really understand, to recognize that when I see it, I suppose. But mm-hmm. I guess maybe
I'm not sure.
A sense of overwhelmedness, I suppose, when reading the paper and just feeling like, okay.
Yeah. So more so that I see more often than off the rails.
Which
is when like you think you're telling some narrative and then it goes in the direction that doesn't make any sense. So this like overabundance of material, or maybe not even material, but this difficulty figuring out like what is the storyline is a thing that I see much more often than off the rails.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so is history of, would you say like the history of then political economy, mm-hmm. how does it relate to history of science?
So a lot of people that are working in history of political economy, quite a few of them are doing history in the way you think history, like historians are doing that. But a lot of historians of political economy slash working on political history of economics slash history of economic thought, right, are thinking about why does economics look the way it does? Right. So especially if they're papers that are on methodology, they'll think like, why does this bit of methodology look the way it does? Yeah. And that's the place where I think it's hooking up with history and philosophy of science with someone like me who's thinking about like, why do people model the way they do? Right. And that's the intersection point that I see most often.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So focusing on a lot of different projects, I suppose. Yeah. So what's kind of looking toward the future and any of your current work at Duke? Like, where do you what do you hope to focus in? And I suppose I'm interested really. Yeah. And what do you hope to do with these your study of economic models?
Oh my God. I have a problem where there are too many things that I want to work on. So some of these are in the family of projects that are pretty close to the ones that I'm doing now and have done in the past. So for instance, there's a second half to the model story that I told you about at the Bank of England. And actually that will also happen at the Federal Reserve, which is, those practicing economists will say, yeah, we totally know that what we're trying to do is construct a coherent narrative. That's what we want, right? So this notion of the narrative, right, as really prominent is something that I find interesting. And the thing that I want to know is, okay, when do we know that narrative is a good one? And why should we think just having a coherent one is a good one? Anything can be a coherent narrative, right? Yeah. But not all of them we would use to figure out how to set interest rates.
Right.
So there is another question that I find that I want to answer maybe soon is, what makes a coherent narrative in economics one that's suitable for policymaking? So that's one. I have other questions about things like, there are certain kinds of models that I'm not familiar with that I think are important, are really important, not just theoretically, but in practice. So one thing that I would like to do is explore a family of like antitrust models, right? Which is going to overlap this interesting theory practice interface.
Right. So what is the goal? Mm-hmm. What is the goal of antitrust models?
That I will tell you when you're older.
Okay.
Yeah. And so there's that. I'm thinking about data filtering methods. So whenever economists get data, right, they have to do something with it.
Right.
So one like really, really not simple, but one thing that they do is they'll try to decompose the data into temporal parts, as in like long-term trends versus short-term trends, right, in order to get information out. So that's something that I would like to look into. There are a whole bunch of other questions that are in other adjacent areas. So I told you I had this interest quite generally in analogical reasoning.
Right.
I kind of want to see what this ends up looking like when we think about precedents in law, making legal judgments, right? Because the intuition there is if you're trying to make a judgment now, what a lawyer might try to do is, what a lawyer does is they'll appeal to judgments that have been made in the past. And intuitively, you would think this only works if the two cases are similar enough, that kind of thing. And yeah, so I'm really all over the place.
So jumping into philosophy of law or philosophy of reasoning in other settings. Oh, this sounds fascinating. So,
and I actually have some side stuff going on in psychology. So I just recently partnered up with a quantitative psychologist, Jolyn Peck at Ohio State. And we've been thinking about fundamental concepts in something like psychometrics. So we worked on a paper about effect sizes in psychometrics. And the idea there, the conceit there is some people have been saying, oh, here's this replication crisis. What do we do? We should focus on effect sizes instead. And what we're saying is no, you have to be really careful. You don't just get an effect size. There's a lot of coordinative work between what you do with your data, what you do with the conceptual framework, all this stuff before you even get something that could count as an effect size to come out. And so we've been thinking about like these more foundational issues in psychology together. So I'm really all over the place these days.
Fascinating. No, I've been doing this. I've been some other colleagues and I. We've been going through. There's someone. Did you meet Edouard Boucher at Pitt?
Yeah.
He's teaching this measurement of the mind course, And so we happen to take a look over his syllabus. We've been reading through. It's basically a film measurement course with focus in like psychometrics. So some really great readings. But yeah, no, that sounds like a very
exactly like that kind of thing, like like construct validation, measurement issues, like all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's a great connection because that you have folks who are philosophers of measurement, but mostly like psychometrics has essentially been that, just like conceptual and methodological issues, theoretical issues in measurement as it relates to mental capacities or something. And that would be a really interesting project to pursue. It's really great to see these kind of different kinds of collaborations that you've been working in. One thing before we get to sort of the final question, I know we've been running a little bit over time.
Oh, that's all right.
So no, you're doing fine. I just want to be mindful of your time.
I'm good.
Okay. I'm familiar, as a more philosopher of cognitive science and psychology with different, societies or like groups of folks who are doing work in those related fields, but not so much about, philosophy of economics and perhaps economic models. And so if there were students or other colleagues that, were listening to this or were interested in, they had these interests and then, realize, hey, this is something that I want to pursue, but I, want to connect with the right people or connect with the right group. Where would they turn to? Are there conferences out there that you're liking right now? Are there little, patches of, I don't know, scholars who are getting together? Like kind of what's happening?
So one thing that comes to my mind right away is that there is always the annual PPE conference. Philosophy, Politics, Economics conference, and that might be like interdisciplinary in a really appealing way for people who aren't sure about how they want to think about philosophy of economics. So that's one. You could always just come here. So hey, students, if you're thinking about going to graduate school and want to do philosophy of economics, come here. There's that. I think there are a lot of things going on in Europe in philosophy of economics. So in Helsinki at the TINT Center, right. There's a lot of philosophers of economics working around there. There are, like, if you go to LSE, for example, there's plenty of philosophy
there's
of economics.
There's a PPE program, right.
And then just generally, like, history and philosophy of economics, I think there are lots of people working on this kind of, well, not the kind of stuff necessarily that I'm working on, but in the area of history, philosophy of economics, there are a lot of people in Europe who are doing this. Any people who are out there listening, if you want reading suggestions, like, I am happy to talk to you, email me.
Okay. No, great. No, that's encouraging to hear. And you're right. I think now that I can think about it in terms of looking at the other kinds of programs, PPEs, it's something that tends to be more like a Europe-centric in terms of the availability, in terms of the programs or maybe even postdocs, things like that. But it's not, it's not unheard of in the States.
So I'm thinking about programs like, in addition to the LSE and to the Helsinki TINT Center. The Rasmus University in Rotterdam has an excellent program. If you're based in Europe, for example, and there are people associated with that program that are really great. So Europe is also a place to look in addition to Duke.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, no, I mean, we're very excited to see these different projects that come to fruition. I know you're kind of, early mid career,
early.
Yeah, I would say, definitely. Oh yeah. I mean, first five, whatever odd years is like, that's like absolutely. So, well, I'm thrilled about your new post at Duke. So why don't we conclude with the question we like to ask of philosophers of science. What do you take to be some of the biggest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
So because I've listened to other episodes, I knew you were going to ask this. And no matter how hard I thought about it, I actually couldn't think of a good answer. So I'm going to answer a slightly different question.
Okay.
What do I think is the biggest challenge for me as a philosopher of science?
Great. What is the biggest challenge for you?
So this is something that I wonder about quite generally about being a philosopher, which is one thing that I don't want to end up doing is engage in what I call belly button studies, you know, like just staring at your navel. So this is I think one of the reasons why I'm motivated to think about economics the way I do. Like, I want to go find out what economists are doing instead of just speculate about the supply demand model by myself, for example, right? So on the one hand, there are a number of different dimensions along which I want whatever it is that I do to connect with other philosophers of science. One day I hope with economists as well. I'd be happy if it goes beyond that. So as you notice, I have a number of projects. Some of them are pretty obviously economics. Some are, you know, intruding into areas like law or psychometrics. Or I have some stuff, actually. I'm working with a colleague, Patricia Palacios, on connections with physics. So if I could get people that are not me to find the things that I find interesting to also be interesting.
Oh, it's so rewarding. Yeah.
But I think that's really hard.
That's true.
And that's the thing that I find that I would like the most, right, out of doing philosophy of science is that.
So this broad, what I hear is some kind of broader impacts into the other, you know, that the disciplines with which you're making sense of.
I mean, listen, if I died and then on my deathbed someone came by and they said, hey, by the way, no economist ever found your papers interesting. I would be a little disappointed.
I was going to say, well, I'm glad. I think, well, already is the case. I was just going to say, like, I was actually going to ask if, I'm curious to see what folks think of your PS or philosophy of science paper. If economists have read it, or I don't know, have you, shopped it around? And I imagine they will. I mean, I think
I have no idea.
it might take longer, maybe like mid or late career, when all of a sudden you're invited to speak at the economics conferences or the law conference or, you know, so, but, I don't know. Having spoken with other philosophers of science more in late stage careers, they seem to get a lot of, you know, share that same sort of excitement toward, doing that work and really being engaged in the practice. But as you mentioned, it's not easy.
And I think we have to think about it because on the one hand, we're a discipline in the humanities. And the one thing that happens a lot in the humanities, we always have to justify being a legitimate discipline. Like, why would someone read philosophy, for example? Right. And there's a stock answer you can give, which is, oh, it's really good for your critical thinking skills.
Sure.
But you kind of want to be able to say more than that. So
it's great for justifying teaching. That's fine. But yeah, for the research you want to do. And well, hopefully, I mean, yeah, well, I'm excited to see, you know, speaking with, bright minds like yourself and others, you know, this, you're seeing more and more philosophers really doing this kind of engaged work in other disciplines. And my hope is that seeing that some of these other disciplines, you know, the psychologists at Ohio State and perhaps, some of the law professors that you might end up speaking with, they start to get a sense of like what the benefit and the value of this kind of interdisciplinary work is, or just being led to think in different ways. So, hopefully we'll see something happen. So, but anyway, Dr. Jennifer Jun, thank you so much for taking some time on this Thursday. It's great to meet you. I really appreciate
having me.
Yeah, have a wonderful rest of the semester. Keep in touch, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Thank you a lot. Have a good one.
Thanks.